Good afternoon. So last time we finished up our discussion of memory caches by addressing the big issue of dealing with writing to memory. That before that we were just saying that, well, our programs are going to read values from memory, and we want to make sure that when they read those values, you know, that's fast. But the problem is that the programs also write values to memory, and we need to make that work with our caches. And we actually had some choices there as far as how we handle it. And we kind of had like two sides we could take. One side is that we could say, well, you know, adding write support's gonna kind of complicate our caches if we like do anything special, so let's do as little as possible. And this gave us kind of a decision where we said, okay, so one thing we have to decide is, what do we do when the program tries to write something, we don't have it cached? Well, in the as little as possible scenario, we're going to just not update the cache. In a alternate scenario, we do what we call write allocate, where we say, okay, well, if the value is not cached and it's being written, we're gonna assume locality still applies here. We're gonna have that value be cached. That's actually kind of complicated to do because we can't just take the value that's being written and put it in the cache, because that's not gonna be a full cache block almost all the time. So we'll have to read in the rest of the cache block from memory, so our write actually turns into a read from the next level of cache. Then we had this second issue of, well, you know, if we are storing our written values in the cache, either because they were modifying a value that was already read, or because we decided that when values are written, we store them in the cache, there's a question of, when do we update the next level? And the simplest strategy for this was what we called write through, that we just do it right away. Why was that simplest? Because this allows us to then forget about the write happening at that point and not need to do any extra bookkeeping, while still avoiding like writing to memory when there's no writes going on. Because it turns out most of a program's memory accesses are just reads. We don't want to make it so when the program reads values that results in extra writes if we can avoid it. But the problem with this write-through strategy, where when the program writes, it writes to the next level, is now the program can only write as fast as that next level, even though we have this faster cache. And this is especially troublesome in cases where we have something like a counter, or, you know, something that's changing a lot that could be stored in the cache. That the write-through effectively prevents it from getting the advantages of being stored there, because we have to keep updating the next level for each of these intermediate changes, even though, you know, we could just do all those updates in the cache and only send the final value to the next level sometime later. So implementing that sometime later policy is called writeback. And in that strategy, we keep the value just stored in the cache with this modifications, and only when we're about to lose the modifications do we actually send them to the next level. Before that, they're marked as what we call dirty, indicating that the cached value is different from the value in the next level. And we just have this extra operation where when a value gets replaced, instead of just replacing it and forgetting about the old value, we first check, well, is this old value actually the version that's in the next level? If not, well, we have to make an update before we can forget about it. I mentioned that sort of most caches either choose the write no allocate write through strategy or the write allocate write back strategy. And a way in which this write through strategy is maybe less bad than it appears is that often a system that uses a write through cache will have like a write through L1 cache and a write back L2 or something like that. So really we're just saying that the, you know, in that design, we're saying, oh, the writes just have to be all be handled by the L2 instead of the L1. So then we talked about a different type of caches. So we said our memory caches indeed help us with memory accesses, and we have this type of memory access that we were dealing with of page table lookups. And, you know, if we think of a page table lookup for a multi-level page table, indeed, it's very helpful that we would have our caches doing that, but that wouldn't be fast enough. That, you know, if our cache takes like 2 cycles to do a lookup, then for a 4-level page table, we're talking about adding 8-ish cycles to every memory access. That's not very nice. And so our solution is that we'd add a special separate cache just for page table lookups. And this cache would be organized in the same kind of pattern we saw for memory caches, but instead of taking in a memory address, we take in just the virtual page number. And instead of giving out data, we'd give out page table entries. And we'd have a design where we had one page table entry for a block in this cache. So with one page table entry per block, that means we have one block, so a block size of size equals one entry, which implies 2 to the 0 entries, or which implies 0 offset bits. So we have no offset bits in this design, but we still need to have, because we're organized in the same way as our memory caches, a set index and a tag. And the way we get that is we take what we're using to look up in the cache, the virtual page number, and divide it up into our tag index. So we have our lower bits of our virtual page number become our TLB index, and our upper bits become our tag, and we have a 0-bit offset that doesn't matter for the cache. And our usage of this is that when we have a virtual address, you know, it has a virtual page number and a page offset, and kind of ideally, we take this virtual page number part, we put it through the TLB, and we get out a physical page number, which we then combine with our original page offset to actually access memory. And we also will get out in this process kind of the permission bits, which we'll have to check. And this is on a hit. Like, sometimes we won't have a hit, in which case we'll do the lookup process we've learned about already of checking the first level and the second level and the third level. Note that because we want to have the TLB give us the final physical page number, we're always storing the last level page table entries. Some questions about our cache writing and how TLBs work before we kind of finish up talking about TLBs and go on to talking about threads. Okay, so a logistics note. We kind of ended up skipping a quiz because of the midterm and the break and because of the chaos before that. We skipped 2 quizzes, but there's a quiz that will be out tonight and due by next Tuesday morning. So when we finished up last time, we had this exercise here. Review that. Where we said we had a 2 to the 12 byte pages, which implies a 12-bit page offset. And in this design, I have a 4-entry two-way TLB, which means we also have 2 sets. And the question is, what's the TLB index for this virtual address? So this virtual address is going to have a VPN and a page offset. The page offset is 12 bits. These bottom 12 bits are the 0x345. So our VPN is 0x12. And we're going to take that VPN and put it through the TLB. And when we do that, we're going to divide it up into our index, and our tag. Again, no offset bits because we store one entry per block. Don't have to worry about offset bits. And how many index bits do we have? Well, we have 2 sets because our cache, remember it looks like this. We have our valid bit, our tag, and our entry. So we have set 0 and set 1. So 1 index bit for 2 sets. So the bottom bit of 0x12 is going to be our index that happens to be 0 here. Then we have 2 and then 1 and then a bunch of zeros in front of that for our tag. Questions about how addresses are divided for this example TLB. And after we get, if we have a TLB hit, we're going to get a physical page number. We're going to combine that with our page offset. And then we're going to use that to access our memory cache to actually access the value the program wants to access. So since we're hopefully comfortable, let's do a little exercise here. So here I have the same TLB design, and we're saying the TLB is initially empty. I have a list of accesses the program makes and information about them. My question is, how many TLB hits, how many misses, and what's in the TLB when this all finishes? Give you a couple minutes to work through that. I would advise you to check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what should be going on. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with how many hits we have. Who thinks we have exactly, I guess, one or less hit? Exactly two hits? Well, exactly three? Exactly four? Five or more? No clue? So we have a plurality on exactly three, and that's what I get. So as a first sort of step here, our TLB is going to take in our virtual page number, and it's going to look it up in its four entries. And we have a set associative TLB here, so we have sets. And with two ways, our sets consist of two blocks. Each block is one entry. That's just what we always choose for a TLB. Remember, our reasoning is, if we wanted to have blocks with more than one entry, we probably should just change the page size instead. And so this is kind of a picture of what our TLB looks like, that we have two indices with two blocks, each with their own valid bits and tags, and a page table entry stored there. So to figure out what goes on in this access pattern, I want to figure out which indices are used. And that's going to be based entirely on the virtual page number. The TLB is never going to see the rest of the address, because it's not, it just needs the page table entry. The page table entry is the same for the whole page, so we don't care about the page offset here. That all happens after the TLB access. Everything that cares about the page offset is later. So I'm going to take virtual page number 440, and I'm going to, so we have this, and we have one index bit that's going to be here. So this is set 0. It's set 0 the second time we access it. And if we repeat this process for all the virtual addresses that are accessed, we find out that FFE virtual page number is 0, D is 1. Everything else is zero. So most of these accesses are going to go to set zero. And the other accesses are going to go to set one. And the physical page number, well, that's going to be the contents that are stored in the TLB, right? It's going to be the page table entry. The main thing that's in the page table entry is a physical page number. So here I have kind of my worked out solution. So you can see here that we first have a miss when we try to figure out what the mapping is for virtual page number 440. And when we find out it's 554, we're going to store that for the page table entry for 440, which is going to tell us that, you know, physical page number 554, and also going to give us like information about, is it writable, is it user mode accessible, and things like that. Then we have our second access to virtual page number 440. That's going to be a hit. Then we access the virtual page number 7FFFE. We found out earlier that it also maps to set 0 because it has that lower bit is a 0, and that's the index bit in this case. So we're going to add it to set 0. We have two ways. So we have two things we can store inside zero, so we can store two different page table entries, no problem yet. Then we access FFFE again. That's a hit. We access page FFFD. Doesn't matter that this address is close. It's back to set one, so it's completely independent, and we're going to store that page table entry in set one. Then we access 6664, and we have to do a replacement. We have only two ways, and 664 has index bit zero, so it has to go to set one. Set has to go to set zero. It cannot go to set one, even though we have a free slot there. And we need to decide what of the two options do we replace in set zero, and our replacement policy is LRU, so it says the least recently used one. Well, we most recently used the 7FFFE entry, so the least recently used one is the 440 entry. So we're going to replace that, and then unfortunately, then we're looking for the page table entry for 440 right after, so that's another miss. And then finally, we reaccess the page 7FFFD, which is in set one. It's been unaffected by everything we're doing in set zero, so that's a hit. Questions on my figuring of hits and misses here? And as for what's actually in the TLB, just write that out here. So the tag, remember, is everything but the index bits. We don't have any offset bits to worry about here, of the VPN, the thing we used to look up in the TLB. So we looked up virtual page number 440. We used the last bit to determine we're going to set index 0. And so everything other than that is our tag. And we're going to have a page table entry stored here. Nope, not the data for the page, just the entry that points us to the right physical page number, gives us the permissions information. And we'll have the same for page 664 and the same for 7FFFD. We also need to track the LRU information. I've represented this with a separate column. Probably we actually just have one bit indicating which way is least recently used. But in order to implement our replacement policy, our TLB must be tracking that information. So questions about the TLB contents? Okay. So assuming I'm not mistaken, I think that's the, we're gonna finish up talking about caches and move on to our next big topic for probably a couple weeks of threats. So we already introduced doing multiple things at a time with processes. We had like cases where we had two or more processes running at the same time, and we're thinking about, well, what order might things happen in? And we're going to be dealing with that more, but we're going to be dealing with threads where we'll have one program that's doing sort of multiple threads of execution, but in the same process. Which means, as we'll discuss later, that like we'll have shared data more so than we have between processes. And it's worth talking about like what are our motivations for wanting to do this? Why do we want to have one process that has multiple threads? And there are kind of two categories of reasons why people use threads that I've sort of called either concurrency or parallelism. And I think it's worth thinking about why are we using threads when we use it, because as we'll learn when we discuss using threads is pretty error prone. So it's probably good to think about, like, is this really a decision that's being done for good reasons? But there are kind of two reasons why you'll see code use threads. One is what I'll call concurrency, which is where we have different things that we want to happen at the same time. So maybe we have a web server, and the way we want to program our web server is we want to write the code to handle each user's request of the web server, as kind of a separate little function, but we want to handle multiple users' requests at the same time. Or similarly, we have a web browser and we want to write the code that handles what to do for each page separately, but we want the multiple tabs to be running at the same time. They're at that point. Or maybe we have a program that's reading keyboard input while playing audio. You know, maybe we have one thread that handles playing the audio and just keeping that going, and another that handles waiting for keyboard input. In these cases, the idea of using multiple threads is that it's kind of easier for the programmer. It's much easier for me to think about how do I write the code to handle one request for my web server? How do I write code to play audio and code to read from the keyboard versus writing one function that checks for keyboard input, plays a little audio, checks for keyboard input, plays a little audio? I can write that function, but it's probably a lot more convenient for me to use multiple threads and basically have the OS handle making those things happen at the same time, rather than me handling it by writing that hypothetical play some audio, check keyboard input, play some audio, check keyboard input function. Instead, the OS, you know, even if we just have one core, will handle, you know, switching between handling keyboard input and playing audio for me by doing the context switching we discussed with multiple processes, except instead of switching between different processes, we'll switch between different threads, different sort of, you know, running pieces of code with their own registers and so on in the same process. And so this concurrency idea is often something we'll use when, even when we don't expect to get any kind of performance benefit from it. That, you know, well, it's something we might do if we expect our program to be running on a single core. It's not because we actually want things to happen at the same time or expect that to be faster. It's because it's just much more convenient to write some programs in a way where we pretend things are happening at the same time and have the OS deal with making that work. The other big reason you'll see multiple threads being used is what I call parallelism, where it's where we have one task, but we want to use more resources to do it. So I'm doing a computation, and probably the most natural way to write the computation is going to be a single function that does one thing at a time, you know, maybe probably has a bunch of loops, but a single function that, like, at least conceptually looks like it's doing one thing at a time that would normally run as, you know, just one thread. But if we just run that and we have multiple processors or multiple cores, well, it's only going to use one of those, and that's probably not how we get our best performance. So we're going to deliberately kind of split something up across multiple threads to get better performance in this case. So we're taking something that, you know, isn't more convenient to have as multiple threads. Like, there aren't really multiple things happening at the same time, but we're going to force that to be the case because we know we have extra hardware that we want to use, so we need to give the OS a way of letting our program use that extra hardware. And I'll call this idea parallelism because the idea is that we're going to do multiple parts of this one task in parallel instead of doing them sequentially. So questions about our motivations for using threads? So I know one reason I'm bringing this up is that when your motivation is the concurrency one, you probably should think about, well, is multiple threads really the best way of doing this? Because as we'll discuss, as we talk about using threads effectively, there's a lot of things you have to worry about that you don't have to worry about in single-threaded code, and that might not be worth, you know, that it more naturally fits how you want to think about the problem. Maybe it is, but often I would argue it is not. So we're going to deal with multiple threaded processes. And a good question is like, how is that different than just what we did with Fork? Because we're not going to be using Fork for this, because we're going to want a different kind of view. So normally, and so far in this class, we've had these single-threaded processes where we have for our process a PID, some open files, we have our memory that's loaded, and we have a single stack and a single set of registers. In a multi-threaded process, we're going to have, like with multiple processes, multiple stacks and registers, but the threads of a process are going to share the same open files, the same PID, the same code, the same global variables, all in one process. And we're going to primarily be looking at how these multi-threaded processes work on something like Linux. And because we are familiar with C and have Linux on Portal, and so we're going to use the pthreads API, which is the main API used on Linux-like systems from C for creating threads. Not saying it's the best one, but it's the main one people use from C, so it's what we'll be doing. And here's an example of creating some threads to make a multi-threaded process using pthreads. So in this example, I'm going to have this code from main running, and before that code runs, we create two new threads, and assuming these new threads don't exit too quickly, it will be the case that at the same time as that code at the end of main is running, the print class list function will be running in a different thread, and the compute pi function will be running in a different thread. And this would be very much like how they would be running at the same time if we forked a new process, meaning that, you know, if we don't have extra cores, they won't really be running at the same time. They'll probably be taking turns, and the OS will handle that. And like we saw with multiple processes, they can run at different speeds. We don't know the precise timing. But here we're creating, you know, two independent threads. Some questions about our this simple multi-threaded scenario where we're just creating threads and having them run. I haven't talked about sort of sharing data or anything else. Okay, so one thing that probably is worth talking about is this, how does the pthread create call work? Because the arguments look pretty intimidating. Some things about these functions look pretty weird. So our pthread create arguments are, first we have a thread identifier. And pthread create, like POSIX memoline, follows this pattern where it really wants to return two values. So one value it wants to return is, was creating the thread successful? And it returns that through this return value, which we're comparing to zero. Zero indicates success. A non-zero value indicates some error, like we're out of memory, for example. And it also wants to return a thread identifier, which is basically the same as a process ID, but for a thread. And to return that, we give it a place to store that thread ID and pass a pointer to that place. Because we can't return two values from pthread create, so that's how they return the second value. So that's our first argument. It's a place to put the thread identifier, you know, which we don't return because we're returning whether the thread creation succeeded or if it failed, why it failed. We also have to pass a function to run. And in this case, I have compute pi and print class list. You might say, gosh, why do these functions take a void star argument and return a void star? That is the only function prototype pthread create supports. So if you want to start a thread, it has to have a function with that prototype that takes a void star and returns a void star. In this case, we probably don't really care about the argument. Too bad. That's what you have to pass to be third create. So you have to pass an argument. And we probably don't care about the return value. Or if we do, we probably don't want it to be a void star. Well, too bad. That's the only return value type supported by pthread create. We'll talk later about how can we make actual useful use of that argument and that return value, given that it's a void star. But that's the only option we have, because the API just doesn't support other things. And pthread create, when the thread runs, it will run this function. When the function returns, the thread will terminate. So this is not like fork, which is pretty fortunate, because fork's pretty confusing. We're not duplicating the current thread. We're starting a new thread, which is starting fresh with this function as kind of its equivalent of main. We also have two other arguments, which I'm mostly going to leave as null. This first argument is attributes for the thread. And the second argument is the arg to pass to the function. We'll talk about, give some examples of what can go in the attributes field later, but basically that's extra settings for the thread. This is where we add them if we want to customize how the thread is created. And the argument is just passed into, in this example, compute pi or print class list when it starts. And we'll give some examples of why that's useful later. So questions about our thread creation? Okay, so let's look at this example here. So here I have a main function that prints about to start thread. Then we create a print message thread, and I'm not checking the return value, but let's assume it doesn't fail for this example. And that thread is going to output in the thread. And then we print done starting thread. And if I run this a bunch of times on my machine, I found that about 4% of the time, it output in the thread. And the rest of the time, it just output about to start thread, done starting thread, and nothing else. There was nothing that failed. That it wasn't out of memory or anything. So what was going on? Why did this not work consistently? Why do we have inconsistent results here? So we have our main thread. So we're running main. We call pthread create. So that's going to run a new thread. So here we're going to print about to start. Here we're going to print done starting. And here we're going to print in the thread. But when I run this, I usually, not always, but usually don't see in the thread output. Anyone can tell me what might be happening here? So way back there. Is it the case that if the main thread exits, the process exits and all threads exit? Yes, that is what's going on here. So the way main works in C, returning from main exits the process. It doesn't exit the current thread, it exits the whole process. It's kind of the same as calling exit with whatever main returns. If main doesn't return, main implicitly returns zero. And this isn't how normal threads work. So what's going on is I have my scenario where main gets to exit, and sometimes that ends up happening after in the thread is printed, and sometimes it ends up happening before in the thread is printed, and it kind of cuts off that other thread and before it can actually output your thread. And this is an example where we have inconsistency because of, you know, the different speeds at which ROS might execute these two independent threads. We saw something similar with multiple processes, though usually that inconsistency was just with the order of output, where depending on how fast things ran, we get different outputs. So I'm going to show kind of two ways of avoiding this issue, one of which I think is better, the other of which I don't recommend, but we'll show to kind of explain what's going on. So the simplest way is that we want to use an equivalent of something like wait PID. And the kind of version of wait PID, but for a thread, is pthread join. So in this case, I'm waiting for the thread to finish. And I also have this null argument. This is where to put the return value of the thread. Just like in wait PID, we have a place to put the exit status of the process. We have a place to put the return value for pthread join. And like wait PID, pthread join won't return until the thread is actually complete. So in this example, you know, we're going to be running our main thread. We do the pthread create. We have our new thread. It's going to output in the thread. Our main thread is going to output done starting thread. And these two outputs actually could happen in either order because there's nothing saying that one has to happen first. But after that, we're going to call join, and that's going to wait regardless of, you know, it's going to wait until the other thread finishes, and then only after the join are we going to actually exit from it. Questions? This fix here, yes.
These being threads,
question, can you send signals between threads of execution? Yes, I'm not going to talk about exactly how that works because there's some, you know, questions that are tricky about like what happens when with a signal to the process, which thread does it go to, but yes, there is a way to direct threads to specific signals. Sorry, direct signals to specific threads. That answer your question? Other questions? So this is the solution I recommend, is that we start a thread and wait for it to finish before exiting. Another solution is that our problem was that returning from main normally exits the process, and we only want to exit the thread. And it turns out we can do that. So pthread exit exits the current thread. It's basically equivalent to returning from the function that started the thread. Except for main, like there's that function's kind of hidden. And this is different than returning from main, because returning from main returns to code that calls exit. And exit for the whole process. And this also works. And what's kind of going on is that basically calling pthread exit is just making one of these threads go away. As long as there's still some around, the process still survives and keeps running. Whereas returning from main says exit the whole process, exiting the whole process says we get rid of this whole thing, which is not what we wanted to do. So this works. I don't recommend it. I think it's very confusing to not keep track of the threads you started. But, you know, we can actually exit one thread without, you know, exit even the first thread, the main thread, without exiting the whole process. The main thread isn't special. The only thing which made it special is that the code that calls main calls exit when it gets control from main. So we've seen pthread join and pthread exit. So pthread join takes the thread ID and a place to put the return value, and also returns whether it's successful or not. And pthread exit exits the current thread, returning the specified value. Kind of, it's the equivalent of exit, but for one thread instead of the whole process. Okay, so questions? Join exit. Okay, so I'll note, I'm going to omit some error checking, but we've seen that pthread create returns whether there's an error or not by returning either zero for no error or some special value for an error. The same is true for pthread join and most of the other pthread functions. And in the pthread create man page, for example, it tells you what constants it returns when there's an error. So for example, it will return E again if it's out of memory or out of some other resource and couldn't create your thread for you. It will return E and val if you asked to create threads with attributes which weren't a valid setting. And you should really be checking these return values all the time. On some of these slides, I won't be because I want the slides to take up less space. But you really should do it, especially for things like pthread create, where you could very well be out of memory. It'd be nice if your program like at least printed a message about it instead of thinking it started a thread and not starting a thread, and it probably causes something really hard to debug. Okay, so let's look at actually sort of using threads, and something we've kind of been missing in examples like this is, well, you know, my thread is running, but it's not doing anything that really takes advantage of it being in the same process, right? It might as well have been a separate program running here and printing in the thread. What we really like to have is have threads that do something and we can get that information back to the rest of our process, or somehow share the information with the rest of our process. And I'll use an example that for bunch of running example here where we're doing something in the parallelism case, that I want to sum up numbers in this array of values. For simplicity of my examples, the values array has 1,024 elements. To make this actually worth doing, we probably would want it to have like many millions of elements, but I have this, you know, array which we could imagine being bigger, but some big array, and I'm going to split it in half and sum half of it in one thread and half of it in the other. And the idea is that if I have hardware with multiple cores, half of the summing could happen on one core, half on the other. And if starting threads is fast enough, this will be faster than just summing it on a single core. And so here, I'm going to do that by keeping two global variables. I'll have a global variable containing my numbers to sum, and a global variable where I'll store the partial sums, so the sum of the first half and the sum of the second half. And I've written a function for what each of my two threads do. I have a function that takes the first half of the array, sums it up, and stores the result in my slot for the first half, so that partial sum. And I have a function which takes the other half of the array, sums it up, and stores the result for the second half, partial sum. And then to run this, I create one thread to sum the first half, one thread to sum the second half, wait for them both to finish, and then sum up the partial sums to get my results. And so if we have multiple cores and summing is slow enough relative to starting an array, starting a thread, then we're going to have this be, you know, take advantage of those multiple cores. So questions on how this code works? So when this is running, we're going to have our values array and our results array stored as our global variables in our program. And we're going to have our two threads created, and we're going to have to allocate a stack for each of them. Now, our whole process is going to have just one page table, so just one memory mapping for all the threads. So that means that when we allocate separate stacks, the stacks have a different address than the other ones, because it's just one big page table. So we're going to choose a new memory address for each of the two new thread stacks. And we're going to set up with the operating system, you know, some new registers the operating system is going to track and context switch to run these two new threads. And the stack pointer that each of these two threads have will point to their two new stacks. They'll have their own program counters that are pointing to the sumFront or sumBack function. And they'll run kind of independently of our main thread, which is probably going to spend most of its time waiting for them to finish. Questions about what this execution looks like. Okay, so there's probably two things that are a little annoying here. So one is that I'm returning my values via this global variable instead of using the return value of the threads. Indeed, I could have used the return value of the threads. I'm showing that we can transfer values separately, mainly because that's going to be a pattern that's useful in contexts where we can't reasonably use the return value. But we could have done that here. Something which is probably a bigger issue is that this is very redundant code. And we'd really like to make this kind of less redundant and more configurable. Right, we don't want to have to write a separate function for each thread when it's essentially the same. We just want to write one function and have it run for both threads. So how can we do that? And here's one way of doing that. So I have one function that's going to be running in both threads, but we want them to do different things. So how can I make this function run twice and do different things? Well, I'm going to pass an argument that's different in each case. And I'm going to use this trick here that definitely worth explaining. So I am passing here this argument I, which is going to be 0 as a memory address in a pointer, or 1 as a memory address in a pointer. So I'm taking 0 or 1, the value of I there, and making it the memory address of the pointer I pass in. Why am I doing that? Because I have to pass a void star. I really want to pass an int, but pthread_create doesn't give me that option, so I'm gonna stash my int as the address of the pointer I'm passing. And then here, I'm gonna sort of id equals the address stored in the pointer argument. So we're going to take the argument, just read out the address that's stored in there. We're not actually accessing memory there, which is good because memory address 0 and memory address 1 aren't valid. But that's okay because we're never actually accessing memory there. We're just kind of cheating, you know, and saying, well, this is a pointer, it stores an address. I'll just use that address as the value I'm actually passing, rather than having it being a meaningful memory address. And when you see C APIs that use a void star like this, you'll very commonly see this pattern. So we're starting with pthreads, but there's other cases where you'll have C libraries where they want a generic function, so they pass a void star. Often you'll see people use it like this because, well, this is probably the most convenient way to pass an integer through that. So in this case, I get my ID, which is going to be 0 or 1. And based on that, I compute the array indices. So I've successfully made my sort of sumThread function. Rather than having a front and a back one, I have just one where I pass 0 for front, 1 for back. Questions? Code here. Now, this is still probably pretty unsatisfying if we're showing it to someone doing at least software engineering stuff. They'd say, this is badly designed code. We have all these hard-coded numbers here. Can't we make this more generic? And we can, but we have this challenge that we want to pass in more than just a number to some thread to really do that. And I mentioned that pthread create, the function has to take a void star argument. So how are we going to do that with a void star argument? And a way we can do that is that I'm going to pass in a pointer to a struct. So I've defined a struct here, thread info, and I've declared an instance of that struct that's going to live in the stack of some of them. Actually, two instances of that struct. And through that, I'm going to pass in start and end that can be used by the thread to implement their for loop. And also, I'm going to use this to replace having as a result in a global array. Instead, I'm going to use this result field in the struct to pass back the computed value. And then you see at the bottom, I just use that result to actually compute things. And now I'm finally using the void star as a pointer. So I'm taking a pointer to this struct, converting it to a void star, converting it back to a struct pointer, and then accessing. So questions about what's going on in our code? We're passing a struct for each of the threads.
Find that struct on the stack and then pass it by reference to that function. If you do some work on a field with that struct in some thread, will those changes persist back to that initial instance of struct?
Question is, when we do some work on the struct in a thread, will those changes persist to the initial instance? Yes, and we actually take advantage of that. So the only reason that this my result equals sum affects our final answer is because that's precisely what's happening. We're passing a pointer to the actual thing on our stack, which means that these two threads are modifying a value that's on the stack of some of them. It also means we have to be careful, right, that this, is in scope from here until here. It's out of scope when the function returns. We need to ensure that while those threads are running, the info array remains in scope, so the threads don't try to access a result that's no longer an allocated variable. In this case, that's not a problem because we have this pthread join that ensures that they are done accessing the result field and all the other fields of the struct before it goes out of scope. Other questions? Okay, so this gives us kind of our, this is the picture of what's going on. We have our two threads. They both have their myInfo local variables that is a pointer to the main thread, the thread that's running sumOls, stack. And they're also both accessing this global variable that is the values array. Now, one thing which might be kind of disappointing here is that we have this global variable. There's another thing where software engineering people would say is probably bad code design. So we can extend this idea to fix that by, instead of passing values in as having it be a global variable, we can add it to our struct. We can just add whatever fields we want to that struct to effectively pass in more arguments to our threads. In this case, you might complain that this is kind of annoying because we're making multiple copies of the values pointers, a separate one for each thread. And yeah, that's not great, but it's kind of what we have to do to make this work. And now we have, this kind of example where now we have this info array and it has two pointers to the real values, which are who knows what, whatever was passed into sum. So questions about this? Oh, oops. About our. So far I've shown examples where we start a bunch of threads, have them wait for them to finish their work, and then move on with the rest of our application. Sometimes we might want to really take advantage of the fact that threads, kind of can do work while our application's doing other things. So what we might really want to do is we might want to say start this summing operation and check on it later. And in the meanwhile, in our main thread, we could do other things. And there's a kind of problem with the design of our function here for that, which is that this info array will go out of scope. So we can't just start the threads and return, because if we do that, then the info struct they're trying to access will disappear, and they probably won't behave correctly. And it probably actually will be really confusing because the memory for the info struct probably won't disappear. It'll instead be the memory for whatever function we're running instead while waiting for them to finish. So what we can do instead is we can apply the same idea but allocate that info struct, say, for in this example, on the heap. So here I've made my info structs a little bigger and I allocate it on the heap. And one thing I need to do when I want to finish up these threads is I need to wait for them. And previously, the way we did that is I stored their thread IDs on the stack of my function. But now I'm going to have an interface where we start the threads, we get a handle, basically, that's going to let us finish and collect the result, and we do some other stuff, then we collect the result later. So to make the waiting for the threads to finish part work, I added the thread that I was previously storing in the stack to this struct. So I have it available later so I can join the threads, make sure they're done before I collect the result. Questions about my this is the asynchronous version. We can start summing and check on the result later, waiting for it if necessary, if it somehow didn't finish in the time we were doing other stuff. Machine questions. And so this gives this kind of picture, right? The threads are running and now they have pointers to this thing on the heap that we ensure we don't deallocate until after we've joined the threads, so we know that they're never going to access something that goes out of scope. So we've looked at a bunch of examples of kind of canonical ways of using threads in our symbol case. So as an exercise, here's some code that uses a thread to compute a value. In this example, we just compute the value and get it. Like, let's assume that we're thinking of the situation where, like, we want to do other work while we're doing that. So, like, we probably really want to do other stuff here and then collect our computer string. But there's a big problem with this code. Something that, you would say won't work. So can someone tell me what that is? What about this code just won't work? Yes. What? So we're never using string pointer, we're never assigning to string pointer. So assuming pthread join doesn't fail, then it's going to fill in string pointer. If it does fail, that is a problem. But if it doesn't fail, it will fill in string pointer. So string pointer will have you set to a value other than whatever the uninitialized junk that was set, you know, here was, set when it was declared was. So question, answer there?
Yeah.
Will the string get deleted when the thread stops? So what do you mean? So the string, which string?
The one that we've computed.
When we've computed, so this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Deleted when the thread stops. Why would it get deleted when the thread stops? What?
I was just a guess.
Okay. Back there?
Isn't the string stored on that thread stack?
Yes. And when the thread goes away, we're going to get rid of the stack. And also, like, this would also be a problem if instead of having all this code, I did the single-threaded equivalent of string pointer equals create string of null. Let's write this. This would also be a problem. In that case, the stack would still be there, but it would be something we'd potentially be modifying as we called other functions, like printf, for example. So the issue here is that this string, it starts being in scope, and it stops being in scope here. So it's no longer valid to use it once create string returns, and really no longer valid to use it once the thread goes away. So this won't work. Someone suggest a fix. How could we make this functional instead? Yeah, back there?
Now instead of saying
that, right? Okay, so one option would be that we could, you know, use malloc here. Another option might be that we could pass in a pointer to space that the main thread has to create string rather than having it allocate its own space. Questions about this example here? So indeed, what's going on is that those stacks go away. And that's the problem.
So if in that thread, like you said, we do a modification of a string that was allocated in the main thread and the pass, do we have to preemptively malloc that string in that main thread?
So the question is, if we did a strategy of having something in the main thread allocated and passing it in, would we have to malloc it in the main thread? We'd have to allocate enough space, but if compute string only writes up to 1,024 bytes, a way we might imagine doing that is we'd have like char string 1,024, pass in the string here, and that would be fine. That wouldn't be malloced because, you know, we could just, it's fixed size, we can just allocate it as a local variable. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Other questions? Okay, so one other thing before we finish up. So pthread join, we've seen, allows collecting return values. And because you could collect return values, if you have a thread you could join and you don't, it's a memory leak. It's a memory leak because the threading library has to keep around that return value. So if you want to avoid the memory leak, either always join or there's a way you can mark a thread as not joinable. And this is what you should do if you don't intend to ever join a thread. You can use this detach call to say, hey, this thread, I don't care about when it finishes. Just get rid of it when it finishes. The return value is useless to me. So when we can do that is by calling pthread detach. We can also use our functionality of the attributes field to have the thread initially start in this detached state, meaning that it will never be joined and will be therefore be cleaned up automatically for us. No memory leak. And this is our first time seeing the attributes of the API. I think it's straightforward, but you probably have to look it up. I have to look it up to use it. We can also set other settings as this kind of attribute suggests, right? There's, you know, it's intended to be flexible. So an example of another thing we can set here is we can say set the stack size. So we saw that when we have new threads, they have a separate stack allocated somewhere. You might have a question of how big that stack is. Well, there is a default, and it actually varies a bunch between systems. But if we have an explicit notion of how much stack space we need, we can actually say, yeah, I want 32K of stack space, please. I know that's how much my thread will need. Okay, so I think I'm basically out of time. As our next big topic, we're going to address this issue of races, of, you know, meaning that there's a case where two threads are doing things and the sort of semantics of what goes on will depend on which finishes first. And this was kind of a trivial example. We're going to be looking at the kind of examples where we can lose data next time. And we're going to have it spend a lot of time talking about how do we actually coordinate threads so we get good, consistent results, you know, and avoid cases like this where I have two threads modifying an account balance, and because of how they run concurrently, their updates, only one of their updates actually happens.